Welcome to The Territorial Period, Leadership and Challenges. As you read, look for personal and administrative challenges facing Territorial Governor William C.C. Claiborne, the mysterious schemes of Aaron Burr that threatened to destabilize the new territory, how the Florida parishes came to be part of Louisiana, troubles involving free people of color and slaves in the new territory, terms, filibustering, dueling, manumission. Because the purchase happened so rapidly, President Jefferson had to act quickly to find a leader for Louisiana. He asked three men who turned him down before asking William Charles Cole Claiborne. Jefferson knew and liked Claiborne. In the contentious or controversial presidential campaign for the election of 1804, Claiborne had supported Jefferson for the presidency. Because Claiborne was stationed nearby as governor of the Mississippi Territory in 1803, he was also a convenient choice. Many people were not sure he was the best choice, particularly because he spoke no French or Spanish. This meant that the person who was put in charge of Louisiana had no ability to communicate directly with the vast majority of the population. Claiborne's co-commissioner and military commander was General James Wilkinson. Wilkinson, too, was a less than ideal choice. Although it was not widely known at the time, Wilkinson had been a secret agent for the Spanish since 1787 and had, at one time, sworn an oath of loyalty to the Spanish king. Despite their potential problems, these two men were the new leaders of Louisiana. Jefferson directed Claiborne to make change slowly, but because Louisiana was still a colony, Claiborne had essentially unlimited powers. The Louisiana Purchase Treaty included a promise that Louisiana would be incorporated into the United States and admitted as soon as possible. It was made a territory of the United States in 1804, with Claiborne appointed as territorial governor. That territorial status lasted for another 8 years. Several events that took place during the territorial period remind us that, in addition to being a period of great change, it was also a time of uncertainty and unrest. Administrative challenges and change. When Louisiana became a territory, Claiborne divided it into 12 administrative units, which he designated counties. By 1807, the territorial legislature, which included representatives who had lived in Louisiana long before the purchase, changed those counties back to parishes. As a result, Louisiana is the only state with parishes rather than counties. Laws, too, reflected compromise between American ideas and Louisiana's French and Spanish colonial past. As we learned in Chapter 4, the 1808 Civil Code was based on France's Napoleonic Code. In contrast, criminal law came to resemble the common law tradition more familiar throughout the rest of the United States. The Burr Conspiracy. Louisiana was still a very unstable place in the territorial period. Those who wanted to evade the law or take part in a form of adventuring, called filibustering in the 19th century, looked toward Louisiana and its uncertain borders as a place of opportunity. One unlikely filibusterer was a former Vice President of the United States, Aaron Burr. Though he served as Vice President during Thomas Jefferson's first term, Burr and Jefferson despised each other. As Jefferson prepared to run for re-election in 1804, he made it clear that Burr would not continue to serve as his second in command. In the wake of Jefferson's rejection, Burr decided to run for governor of New York. Burr also had a long-standing personal feud with former Secretary of the Treasury Alexander Hamilton. When Hamilton wrote a newspaper article that was very critical about Burr and his ambitions to be governor, Burr challenged Hamilton to a duel. Dueling, a combat between two persons, especially one fought with weapons in front of witnesses, had been a common way for men to settle disputes in the early national period. By 1804, it was becoming less acceptable. Dueling had been outlawed in both New York and New Jersey by that time, but New York enforced the ban more vigorously than its neighboring state. Thus, Burr and Hamilton decided to leave New York and cross the border into New Jersey to settle their affair of honor. On the morning of July 11, 1804, Burr shot Hamilton, and Hamilton died the next day. Charges were filed in both states, but none ever came to trial. Burr even finished out his term as vice president. What Burr's plans were next has never been entirely clear. They included discussions of such ambitious schemes as taking over New Orleans and stripping the city of its valuables. He would then invade Mexico, where he would establish himself as ruler. Whether these ideas were serious or simply talk, they never took place. General James Wilkinson had originally conspired, plotted, schemed with Burr, but ultimately decided to inform Jefferson of Burr's schemes. Burr was tried and acquitted of conspiracy charges, but the trial for conspiracy and his murder of Hamilton deeply damaged his reputation. Burr went into exile in England, but returned to the United States in 1812. He spent the final years of his life practicing law in New York. West Florida Rebellion. There was also unrest along the borders of the area known then as Spanish West Florida, and today as the Florida Parishes. Although the Spanish still controlled the area in 1810, English-speaking migrants from the United States dominated the region's population. Many of them wanted to become a part of the United States. To accomplish this goal, they staged their own revolt against the Spanish in 1810. The rebels declared themselves an independent republic called the Republic of West Florida. They even adopted a flag with a blue field and a single white star. Their independence did not last long. 3 months later, the United States declared West Florida part of the Louisiana Territory. The Florida parishes were formally incorporated into Louisiana after it became a state in 1812. Free people of color and slaves. Louisiana's diverse population also presented its new administrators with unexpected challenges. Free people of color, who had become a significant part of Louisiana's population, especially in New Orleans, presented the United States with an unfamiliar situation. Claiborne was both astonished and alarmed when he realized that local militia units included two groups made up entirely of free men of color. In one letter back to Washington, D.C., he referred to these armed free men of color as his principal difficulty. The free men of color wrote Claiborne asking that their militia units be retained. They quoted from the Louisiana Purchase Treaty in making their case. In 1804, Claiborne decided on a compromise that kept the militia units intact for the time being, but put white officers in charge of them. Claiborne also oversaw the adoption of a new slave code in 1806 based on U.S. rather than French or Spanish practices. The code still allowed for manumission, setting free of slaves by their masters. However, the privilege of self-purchase, called cortesión by the Spanish, was no longer available to slaves, making it all but impossible for a slave to be freed without the approval of his or her master. Slaves were also prohibited from making complaints against their masters. When they committed crimes of a public nature, they were tried in a separate system of courts that gave out harsh punishments. Slave law and life changed in another important respect as well. After 1804, the federal government made it illegal to import slaves into Louisiana from any place outside the United States. Similar legislation became the law for the entire country in 1808. This led to a rise in the importance of the domestic slave trade. Rather than being brought to the United States from Africa or the Caribbean, slaves were now sent from coastal states like Virginia to be sold in Deep South locations like New Orleans. Although this was a national law, Claiborne made an exception to it in 1809. In that year, a large group of refugees who fled Haiti, Saint-Domingue, and settled in Spanish-controlled Cuba were forced to migrate one more time when the Spanish ejected them from Cuba because of tensions between Spain and France. 9,000 of them set sail for nearby Louisiana. The refugees were almost equally divided among white people, free people of color, and slaves. The fate of these 3,000 slaves created a problem for Claiborne. Although it was technically illegal to import slaves, Claiborne needed to make an exception. He felt it was inhumane to leave so many people stranded, and most slave owners refused to leave their slaves behind or abandoned on boats at the mouth of the Mississippi River. Among other things, this 1809 wave of immigration nearly doubled the size of the city of New Orleans in a single year. The 1811 Slave Revolt. Fear that slaves who had come from Saint-Domingue would bring knowledge and experience of the island slave rebellion was one reason some in Louisiana feared the 1809 slave refugees. Although there is no clear connection between the two events, in 1811, slaves upriver from New Orleans rebelled against their masters in what became the largest slave revolt in U.S. history. In January 1811, an enslaved man named Charles led others to take control of the plantation of Miguel Andre. The slaves believed there might be a large collection of weapons on the plantation, but were disappointed not to find them. Most of the slaves were armed only with farm tools. As they began their approach toward New Orleans, they convinced other slaves to join them. Their numbers certainly exceeded 150 and may have been as high as 500. But the poorly armed rebels were no match for the local militia and U.S. Army forces that surrounded them 2 days into their march. Many of the slaves were killed in the fighting that followed. Those who were captured were taken to New Orleans for trial. 21 slaves were hanged, and their heads were then placed on poles along the route they had taken toward New Orleans. This would serve as a warning to other slaves who might consider rebellion. Although the 1811 slave rebels were defeated, the sheer numbers of slaves involved make the revolt an important part of the nation's history. Special feature: the Queen of Voodoo, Marie Laveau. One of the most interesting people in New Orleans history is Marie Laveau, the Queen of Voodoo. Laveau was born on September 10, 1801, in New Orleans to mulatto, mixed-race parents. Marie was a free woman of color, the first in her mother's family to be born free. Marie Laveau married Jacques Paris in 1819 at St. Louis Cathedral, and the couple had two daughters, although neither daughter lived a long life. After the death of her husband, Marie became known as Widow Paris, the name that is inscribed on her tombstone. Later in life, Marie had seven more children and her relationship with a man of French descent named Louis Glapion. Two of those children, both daughters, survived into adulthood. Even though she was a devout Catholic, Marie Laveau is most famous for being the Queen of Voodoo in New Orleans from the 1820s until the 1860s. Voodoo developed from traditions rooted in Africa, Haiti, Cuba, Trinidad, and Brazil, and integrates the belief of one God, like in Christianity, with a belief in spirits. Folklore suggests that Marie Laveau sold charms, favors, and prophecies. In addition, she charged fees for communicating with the dead. Local legends connect Marie Laveau with basically anything unusual that happened during her lifetime in New Orleans, even though most of the stories cannot be proved. Near the end of her life, Marie Laveau gave up her position as voodoo queen and devoted her life to doing charitable work, such as meeting and praying with prisoners. She died on June 15, 1881. To learn more about Marie Laveau, you can visit the Voodoo Museum in the French Quarter in New Orleans. Her tomb in St. Louis Cemetery No. 1 is also a popular tourist attraction. Is there anyone today who reminds you of Marie Laveau?